Welcome to the Good Manners Map with me, Monique Chambers, where we take a journey around the world learning about social etiquette and traditions. Welcome to the Good Manners Map with me, Monique Chambers, and my guest this week is Leila, who's going to talk to us about the etiquette and traditions in Syria. So, obviously we've seen on the news how Syria is today, but before the troubles, Syria had quite an interesting mix of cultures and then quite an interesting mix of traditions. What can you tell us about being a child in Syria?
Well, okay, yes. So I actually wasn't born in Syria. My parents are Syrian, and I used to go as a child on holiday. Absolutely loved it. It is a melting pot of cultures, as you said, and you know, at some point and up till today, all religions live peacefully together there. I think they were the only ones at one point in history that allowed the Jews in and welcomed them. There are Christians, there are Muslims, and they just all get along peacefully. At the center of, you know, where history started, you know, Damascus is one of the oldest cities in the world. And they're just very sort of proud people. They very traditional, they do everything themselves, they are very hospitable, and you know, I'm proud to have my Syrian roots, absolutely.
Fantastic. So are there memories you had of when you visited as a child, or are there things that your parents did for you at birthdays, or is there particular cakes and things like that that you might have now?
Well, I obviously follow a very different lifestyle now, but there are childhood treats that definitely, you know, you do sort of treat yourself every now and then. The memories of going in summer with my mum, yeah, we loved it. I mean, my grandmother had a wonderful home with a balcony, and one of my favorite things was, you know, sweeping it with her and getting, you know, wet and in your bikini and, you know, food. Food is very prominent there. It's the center of everything. Any celebration, any get-together, and there's a whole spread of, you know, the traditional things and the sweets especially. You know, our sweets are terribly loaded with sugar, but so, so good.
So what's the other main type of ingredients? Is it almonds, perhaps?
I suppose they use pistachio. Pistachio is a very sort of common in desserts, and we have the kanafe, which is the rice vermicelli.
Oh yes,
that, you know, you can have it with the cheese or without, and it's sort of dipped in syrup, and all the baklava, obviously, and certain puddings that are eaten at certain times of the year, depending on celebrations and feasts and things. Yeah, so
what are the main celebrations throughout the year? Because you have this mix of religions. Obviously, each religion would have its own, but are there sort of national holidays or particular feast type events where there would be these lovely sticky sweets coming out?
Definitely. I think one of the two biggest ones are Eid al-Fitr, which is just after Ramadan, which is 3 days long, and that's where you get up and you have the morning prayers and the mosque, and then that's it. Families gather, big feast, lots of food, visiting each other's homes, and sweets are definitely a big, big thing then.
And is there meat and fish involved in the diet as well, or are they mainly
they
vegetarian?
Do. No, no. Arabs are huge meat eaters. You will never encounter an Arab that says, no, I don't eat meat. That's just incomprehensible. Definitely, definitely big on meat, and rice is sort of often served with the main dish. Yeah, I mean, vegetables are definitely there. Their produce is wonderful because of the sun and the climate, so everything tastes so wonderfully good. I mean, that's a big childhood memory, the crunchy cucumber that actually tastes like a cucumber, the vibrant tomatoes, just, you know, the spread that my grandmother would make, breakfast, lunch, and dinner. You know, it's a huge thing. And then you would wake up after your siesta in the afternoon, after you've had dinner, then you would have tea with the special curly cheese we have and watermelon, you know, so it's constant food, entertaining.
What's curly cheese?
I call it curly cheese, but it's a sort of white, mild cheese, sort of semi-soft, and it's sort of wrapped in like a pleat, and it's quite salty, so you'll soak it in water, and then you sort of shred it, so it almost looks like sort of permed hair sort of thing. And
do you eat that just on its own, or is it with the bread, or?
Definitely the Arabic bread. You can either make sandwiches. My mother used to make those when we go to the pool for the day, or you have it with watermelon. It's sort of like the Greeks when they have halloumi and watermelon, that sort of combination. It's a type of cheese that sort of resembles that sort of texture.
Okay.
Yeah.
And is it sharp, or is it it's a mild?
Oh, it's mild. It's mild, definitely. It's not like a strong French cheese, no.
It's something that you'd have only on the special occasion after Ramadan, or it's something that
That's something all year round. I think with Ramadan, there are certain dishes that will be made, and then during the Eid al-Fitr, which is just after the celebration, you would have certain sweets and things that would also be made specifically for those 3 days. And that's for children, it's a really exciting time because they get to wear new clothes. It's sort of a new outfit.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, they get pampers and you just sort of, it's an open 3 days where people might just knock at your door and come in unannounced. You know, it's 3 days of visiting each other and just eating and celebrating.
So you're saying that people just knock on your door. Is there outside of these festivities, if you're inviting someone to your home for dinner, would you turn up, or would you expect your guests to turn up exactly at the time you've invited them, or is there a different sort of rule?
Well, from what I can remember, I think the Maltese are quite similar in this respect. They might have taken this from the Arab culture, but I don't recall. Maybe one or two people, if you're having a party or a dinner, might show up on time, but a lot of them would show up later. Okay. I don't think it was ever on the dot, 8 p.m. ring the doorbell.
Right.
But again, I think it depends on the occasion, but yeah.
And is most of the food, like, I don't want to say mezze, but, you know, lots of different dishes, lots of different choices, so that there's
absolutely
abundance. You're not waiting for one thing to come out of the oven anyway, so
no,
there's a lot of...
No, it's a huge spread, and you'll have all the kibbeh and the hummus and the dips and, you know, fettuch salad and all these things. Yeah, definitely. Yes.
And so people come in. Would they normally bring a gift to the home?
Well, when I asked my father this, actually, out of interest, he says, well, really, it's not compulsory, and you would sort of, what happens is if someone hosts a dinner party, you just sort of give back the favor, and you would host a dinner party, and you would go to them the next time. But I do remember, because, I mean, I've grown up, and even when I go back to my mom, I always take something in my hand for her. And that's how I was brought up and what I remember. So I think people will either bring some flowers or traditional Syrian biscuits, and then especially chocolate. Chocolate Syrians love, and then after the dinner they will serve that around to the guests with the coffee.
So obviously take chocolates that you like, not the ones you're trying to get rid of.
Yeah. I think they, I mean, if you were living in Syria, they would have, you know, the patisseries and mm-hmm. chocolatiers and things with typical chocolates and things, you know, dark springs to mind, the dark coating, and then there were lovely marzipan sweets that I remember growing up with, the little sort of fingers of marzipan, which were really, really good, but naughty.
But, yeah. You know, when you're, you know, visiting family and things, I think these things are allowed.
Absolutely, actually. Absolutely.
No calories. So what other special occasions are there through the year?
Then you have, well, the first one of the year, I think, is the Independence Day, which is April 17th, my birthday.
Ah.
So there must be a really strong connection with why I chose to come into the world that day. So that's a big thing where, you know, people will be singing traditional songs, or you'll hear, you know, songs being played from shops and house mm-hmm. windows, you know, windows open, and flags will be flown high. Then there's the Cotton Festival, or what used to take place, obviously, before what's going on now. And that's where Aleppo, who they export the majority of the cotton that is made in Syria, comes from there. And then people will come and buy things in the factories and look at what's on display. And then the other major holiday is the Eid al-Adha, which is after the Hajj. And that's 4 days long. And again, it's prayers. And that symbolizes Ibrahim, which sacrificed his only son to God. So that holiday often is a misconception to people. They think it's atoning for your sins, when really it's all about serving your God and understanding the sacredness of, you know, the meaning behind that. So what happens is they'll slaughter the animal, for example, and they will say God's name first to bless what they're about to eat, and that God gave us the power and the strength to be able to kill and eat animals. So we're sort of a little bit higher up the food chain, shall we say. And then, yes, so every time you do slaughter an animal, you will say God's name, and you will be... And then what happens with this animal for that specific holiday is a third will be kept for family and close relatives to eat, and then another third gets given to the poor, and the last third gets given to friends. And that's a way of showing their willingness to give up something close to the heart, something that's of benefit, and again, just sacrificing in the name of God.
And so it's you said a four-day festival.
Yes.
So there's prayers, food. Are there any other rituals that happen through this time?
I'm not so sure. I mean, I grew up with parents who, my mum was more religious than my father, shall we say. So we grew up sort of in Europe and had that conflicting, who do we listen to and what do we do? So I'm not really a strict Muslim. I was born into a Muslim family, but we weren't really taught mm-hmm. the ins and outs of the religion in detail. And we weren't really living in that environment. So,
but in those, the sort of halal preparations and things are something that were important.
No, I don't think we really bothered with. No, we really weren't very strict at all.
Okay, but you see halal butchers here in Malta, so it's obviously a lot of people using the services.
Yes.
Per se, but like you said, it is misconstrued, because when you read the prayer, it's actually quite beautiful.
Yes, absolutely.
I don't have a copy of it in front of me, but that's what they will do.
They will say, you know, those prayers, and yeah, it is. If you delve into the religion, just like any other religion, they are all beautiful, and that's what I do. I take something from every religion, and I like to just sort of take the goodness from each one, and think that we're all one, and that we shouldn't, you know, it's too long to get into, but. Yeah.
Too small a world, frankly. And what about things like weddings? Because obviously the cultures there, you would have had every type of culture. So, because I'm asking you, I'll hear one answer, but if I was asking, you know, somebody from the Jewish faith, obviously you'd hear something different.
Yes.
What's the predominant wedding culture?
Again, I think it depends if you're talking old-fashioned or now, because now a lot of them have taken, you know, they've adopted the Western sort of way, and they'll do nice luxury weddings in hotels, and it'll be a mixed wedding. But the old-fashioned sort of once upon a time was men and women were separate on the wedding day.
Okay.
They didn't mix together. They might have come together towards the end, and then you might have seen the couple. But the women would have their own celebration with dancing and things, and the groom might make an appearance so that the women can see him. But the woman wouldn't really go to the men.
The men,
it's sort of a really sort of, again, based on food, and it's a chance to get together and just, you know, be gluttonous.
Is there specific meanings within the food that you have at weddings? Is there particular sauces or cakes or anything like that that sort of show, you know, I am from, you know, this part of town, or I
wouldn't know.
Okay.
I don't think so. They might have just had the usual, you know, general cuisine and things, but the wedding is a big function. The actual civil religious part of the ceremony can happen months before, and that can either be in the court, at the court, or in the bride's home. So my parents, for example, a lot of it is an arranged marriage between families, and that's what my parents had many, many years ago. And the sort of little wedding part of it, the marriage happened at the home with the two fathers present and the, you know, special man who comes from the court to marry them. And then your actual party can happen either straight after or months afterwards as well. So
and then do they have a sort of break and have a honeymoon type thing, or because you've had this, you have this big party?
I'm not sure about honeymoons. Again, it might be a Western thing, but obviously these days they will go off and do something together. So, I mean, my parents did at the time, but my father wanted to get out of Syria and he wanted to explore. So, you know, they definitely, you know, they went to the south of France, I think, and a few other places.
But so the actual wedding ceremony itself, there aren't many of these separate, you know, the man, woman doing separate parties, that doesn't happen so much, or that happens out in the countryside, do you think?
I think if you're quite strict and you want to stick to the rules, then yes, you will have the separate. And a lot of entertaining, because I grew up in Saudi Arabia for 10 years, from, you know, about 3 years old to 13. So I used to witness, you know, my father wouldn't be in the home, for example, or he'd be upstairs and my mum would entertain. It would only be women coming into the fancy dining room and they would have the food and things. And that's when I know they wouldn't come on time and then, you know, half an hour late. And so, yeah, there is a lot of this separateness. And then sometimes, you know, there are the weddings where they are mixed and then the couple are put on a sort of pedestal and elevated so that all eyes are on them. You know, they won't have the cutting of the cake necessarily. They are doing this now, obviously, but my father remembers back in the day that they didn't really have that culture and tradition of doing that, and they don't really have the speeches like the best man and father of the bride. And
Probably not too much exposure of people's characters.
No.
And what about when children are born? Are there particular things that happen there?
Well, I think, again, the gift giving, you know, you might have the clothes and jewellery. Jewellery keeps coming up. Same for the weddings. Women will have, you know, the occasion to wear all their nicest things. And for the birth, relatives and friends will often give, if it's a girl especially, they'll give earrings, for example, or maybe little ornaments. And then one thing that when I was speaking to my father, he said, your grandmother had once told me off after you were born, because I'm the eldest, and he hadn't gifted my mother jewellery, which is apparently a cultural thing that, you know, next time round he remembered, though, I have to gift my wife a piece of jewellery after the birth. So that was something that had come up.
I think that's a tradition we could adopt here, actually. I think a lot of people would be happy to receive presents on their children's birthdays as well.
Yes, yeah, and I think it's quite nice. I mean, it doesn't have to be jewellery, but it is nice to honour your wife who has just gone through that whole process of, you know, birthing a life into the world. So it is, you know, there are lots of beautiful little things about, you know, the Arab culture, that it is quite sort of, it is nice in a way. I know everyone thinks that they sort of put down the women and they're, you know, servants and all that sort of subservience, and but there is an element of beauty to sort of keeping her sacred and,
yeah, that's, like you say, misconstrued today.
Yes.
What else can you tell us about the way of life, the sort of even the day-to-day?
Day-to-day, I mean, again, we didn't really grow up in that culture. I left at 13 and had a big culture shock moving back to England. So my parents would have had something very different. But I mean, you know, my mother will tell me stories like they weren't allowed to flirt. And if someone opposite the roads, you know, was eyeing them and she was eyeing them, the grandfather would come out and say, what are you doing? And, you know, get back inside. And so it was really quite a protective, but then at the same time, a really lovely thing that, you know, family would always gather together and they would go out and have picnics. And that's something that I really miss, because I think now we've come to a point where we're not a village community anymore and everyone lives in different corners of the earth and you hardly get to see your family. I mean, maybe not so much in Malta, everyone's sort of close together, but I have family in France and America and England and Germany, so we don't always get to see each other, you know, regularly. So they grew up with that love and closeness.
So I'm guessing, was it quite unusual for you to have moved out of Syria all those years ago? Obviously today a different story, but all those years ago when your father decided to take you all to Saudi, quite unusual?
I was born in England, and he had already left with my mom,
right,
from Syria. And then going to Saudi Arabia was a big thing then for expats, because they would go and work in the hospital. I mean, my father's a doctor, so he went, you know, to work in the hospitals over there, and it's a big expat community. So you would live in compounds, and people can't really fathom that. But it's, you know, you'd have a swimming pool and a recreation centre, you know, so it was quite a nice life. We'd get picked up in the big yellow buses and go to, you know, the British school. So, you know, my childhood was really, you know, it was fabulous. I didn't have to cover. Uh-huh. I only started having to wear the black abayas and things just before leaving, because, you know, you got to an age where if you were walking in the malls and things, you had to cover.
So what sort of age is that happens to young ladies?
I think that depends, I mean, how much you're following living there, and if you're Saudi, or, I mean, the Saudis might dress their young girls from an early age, but definitely before you get to sort of teenage and puberty, is you definitely have to start covering when you're in public.
And is that the same in Syria as well?
Well, they don't wear the black per se like the Saudis. They might put headscarves, and I think it's a very personal choice. You know, the hijab is something that women will say, it, you know, it may not be a religious thing. It's just something that I do between me and my God because I find comfort in it. So I don't think it's imposed and forced.
Okay.
It's a personal thing, and, you know, tied into your beliefs, and yeah.
So do you mix with the Syrian community here in Malta and elsewhere, or you? It's very distant now. You don't really know anybody. I'm just wondering if there are, you know, ways to keep any traditions alive.
I think there are communities here, especially, you know, maybe the refugees that have come here and people who work with them. And I try to donate and do charitable things, but I haven't really got into the community as much as I could potentially. And I think their perspective on life and where they've come from, things are so different. And I never know when someone says, where's home? I never know where to say, because I just feel like I'm this free spirit around the world, because I grew up in England and I have sort of Arabic roots. And then I moved here and there and lived in France. And it's, there isn't one place where I grew up all my life, like, you know, someone from Syria who's had to be plucked out, who knows their tradition and cultures. And so, yeah, I do feel connected and I'd like to go back there and help one day, but I don't feel, sometimes I feel like I don't belong in a way, because I don't know enough about the culture, and my parents didn't really sort of regale us with stories. And
do you have advice from your parents, you know, if you're going to a family occasion, what you need to wear or what you need to take with you or anything like that? Is there any restrictions in that sense today?
I don't think so. I think, you know, everyone's quite modern, but I mean, you wouldn't go wearing something really slutty, for example, or revealing. You know, you would have a little bit of respect, especially if you're going to people who are a bit elderly or older. And, you know, I've been brought up to always take something in my hand. Obviously, you wouldn't take alcohol if you're going to a Muslim family.
No.
But, you know, flowers, chocolates, a big box of, you know, the nice patisserie from a local Arabic, you know, sweet shop or something. And I mean, yes, growing up, we were always told, and we go to so-and-so's family, you know, they're quite religious, and make sure you don't say this or do this. And it's, you know, it's frustrating in a sense, because you should be allowed to be yourself. I know you have to be a certain way in certain places, but you shouldn't.
No, but are there things that then we should be aware of? So if we're invited to someone's home, not see in today's day, unlikely in Syria, but if you're invited to someone's home, is there something you should or should not do when you're...
Well, there are things like, the Arab world is known for being very clean. So if you go into a particular home and people are taking their shoes off before going in and leaving them, you know, at the special entrance or whatever, then you would obviously follow suit and make sure that if they're doing it, you do it. Mm-hmm. If not, then when you're sitting with a group of people, maybe before you sit down to dinner, for example, you would never show the sole of your shoe facing towards someone because that's a sign of disrespect. And then when a woman walks into a room, the men will stand up, which I find really lovely. And then every time a new guest arrives and comes into the sitting room before they sit down to eat, for example, then everyone stands up.
Okay, so men and women stand up. Okay.
Yeah, so every time a new guest comes in, usually they'll do the rounds, do the kissing on the cheek and go around everybody. So
Do you kiss in a particular way? Because I know the English kiss differently to the Italians and sometimes that can be quite interesting. Is there a left-right or right-left rule?
I think it depends who it is and some do two, some do three and some do four. So, one cheek,
you're
one cheek.
You're going to get it right eventually.
So I think it just, it depends. But I mean, I suppose the natural way is for your right cheek to go to their right cheek. Sometimes it might, but yeah, I just remember sort of that was the natural start with the right, move to the left, and then you might do a right again, for example. But you would, you would do the rounds and kiss everybody. And I think it depends, if it's men, women and the cultures, and maybe you don't, the men, women won't approach if they're quite religious.
But the men do the kiss separately and the women would do the kiss as well, and you just may not do man and woman.
Yeah, if it's a relative or something, maybe. But I think if it's someone who's coming to the husband for dinner, for example, I mean, a woman will cover her hair usually if the man's bringing someone to the home.
Is there anything on like eye contact or... which hands to use when eating, anything like that that we should be aware of? Just, real basics.
Well, I think that there is something about eating with the right hand, unless you're holding a knife and fork, because the right hand symbolizes something and the left hand is usually, I think the French. Yes, exactly. So there is something along those lines, which I think a lot of cultures adopt.
They're
so hospitable that if you then ask for a second serving, then be prepared to have the dish, really loaded, because they want to make sure that you're fed well. And, if you then get tired and you sort of say, well, I'm going to go, they will always be polite and say, no, please feel free to stay longer. And, you don't have to say yes, but they will always do it to make you feel at home and that you're part of them.
Uh-huh. What other things should we be aware of? Going into someone's home, or even, like I say, leaving. Is there a point in time where you shouldn't leave? I mean, obviously, once the meal is finished and whatever, but is there the hostess would say, would it make you leave? Or would they just keep going until the last person?
Sort of, it'll just happen naturally. The only other thing is the host will come into the sitting room, for example, and when the dinner is ready, they will tell them, okay, you can be seated now. And then everyone would go through, which is quite common here as well. But, yeah.
No, and it's always difficult to get people to sit at the table when the food is ready. It drives me insane. Because I'm always getting very stressed thinking everything is timed to perfection. But maybe with the multiple dishes, it's actually a less stressful way to cook. Mm. What else should we know?
What would you like to know? There's the childhood ceremonies.
Yes, anything like that would be interesting.
That's, as far as I can remember, there aren't really any coming of age traditions like the communion or the bar mitzvah and things. The only thing that they do, which is, I think, the Muslim way, is the circumcision for the boy. Mm-hmm. And that's usually, nowadays it would happen close after birth and really young, whereas sometimes they would do it sort of maybe a little bit older. It depends again on the family and the timing. Everything is different, but that's a sort of celebration where there might be some semi-public, festivities and food and things. Okay. Normally that is something, that's the religious side, that the boy is
circumcised young. And are there still arranged marriages today? Is that sort of all... Yes, it still happens, or is it less and less common?
I would be interested to know the statistics, but it definitely does still go on because it's part of the culture. But then there are more couples who, if they do fall in love and things, then his side of the family will go and ask for her hand in marriage. And maybe it's not as taboo as before, but yes, before and definitely now, I would imagine there are still families who will choose You know, and then way back when there was, I read a post that said that the woman, the mother was the one that was responsible for going to a hammam and finding or yes, so it was a sort of whole process around that, but I don't know how common that is nowadays.
I sometimes think they're a good idea. You know, matched on interests or social scale, whatever. But then on the other hand, you know, chemistry is chemistry at the end of the day, but you know, something's fade.
Yeah, it's very difficult because, you know, relationships are hard work. And I think either before people didn't voice up enough and they just dealt with what was given to them. Mm. And even if they were frustrated, they just did, you know, the wife thing and the husband would go out and work. And the arranged marriage thing can work really well sometimes because people haven't had anything else before that. So they learn to really love each other. But then at the same time, it can be very difficult.
I can imagine, yeah.
You know, my parents have a 14-year age gap and, you know... Okay. 23 years later, it just, you know, that was it. It got to a point where...
Oh, and so how is divorce seen?
Not very well. I think they will try to do anything as much as possible to not resort to that. And maybe now people are a bit more open if they've left the country and things, but it's not really... They will sort of say, please, you know, you must try and work on it and things, and it's not the nicest thing. Yeah.
And just the last question, funerals... What yes. happens in burial ceremonies or?
So for funerals, basically the body is washed. I think usually it's within 24 hours you bury them quite quickly. So the body will be washed and the person who is washing the body will ask if, I don't know if this is just old fashioned or if it still takes place, but if the deceased has left any debts behind, who is going to carry these for them so that their soul can rest in peace. And usually it's the eldest member of the family that will take that on. Mm-hmm. And then they're wrapped in silk or linen cloth. And then the men are the only ones that will attend the actual burial. The women won't. Obviously, the prayer is said, the Fatiha from the, you know, the first, the opening of the Quran, that prayer is recited over the body. And then I've read somewhere that once the graveyard or not the tomb, because they don't do the tomb yet, but once it's covered, the grave is covered, then the women can visit.
Right, I see.
And so 3 days later, they'll come and put flowers, and they won't actually put a tombstone for 40 days because they believe, again, I don't know if this is just from the past or if they still do it, but they believe that the soul will still be present there for 40 days, so they won't put a tomb until then, otherwise it's trapping the soul.
This has come up in other interviews, in fact, is 40 days
yeah,
thereafter.
There's a big thing with 40 days for many, many cultures.
Yeah.
It's quite a beautiful thing, because, I mean, I am a firm believer in past lives and the soul being recycled.
It's quite a nice thing to have that hope that your loved one might actually sort of come back to you in a sense, you know. Yeah. Anyway, it's been fantastic talking to you about Syria and a little bit of Saudi thrown in. Thank you very much for that extra richness.
Thank you for having me.
Talking to Leila, I'm Monique Chambers here on The Good Manners Map. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us on our journey around the world on The Good Manners Map here on Campus FM with myself, Monique Chambers, and the technicians Carmelo and Samuel. You can hear this programme on Mondays at 1:30 p.m, Thursdays at 9:30 a.m, and again on Fridays at 8 p.m. You can also download as a webcast from MaltaUniversityBroadcasting.com.